form on issues of the aesthetic side of architecture. And in the first of those lectures, we discussed how form affects our kind of visceral experience of things, how just through our senses we perceive form. We looked at these 12 elements of form that help us talk about that. And then in the second lecture, we were looking more not at how we react to form in our viscera or directly through our senses, but how we react to form also through our intellect, through our thought process. And that form is this powerful thing that visually you kind of go straight to the head. You go straight to our thought process about something. And we learn something. We get something communicated to us. So we looked at several examples of that. We looked at a series of buildings that displayed a sense that society, the world, your life is all about order. And we looked at that in the Renaissance when they were discovering science and mathematics, and they began to think, well, that is what the world is about. It's about order. We can see that somehow the universe is this ordered thing. And so they began to make buildings that depicted the world that way, as this ordered device. And something like the Villa Rotunda by Palladio, this incredible kind of mathematical puzzle that says, this is what the world is about. It's about order. Your life is about order. It's about that kind of structure and clarity and dominance of order. And then we could see, likewise, a completely different kind of building that was depicted in another era where they were much more interested in, well, maybe that order is a little stifling. Maybe that's actually not completely accurate. Maybe things are a little more ambiguous. Maybe things are a bit more complex. Maybe the world is more complicated than that. And we begin to get buildings like San Carlo alla Quattrofontana that is debating with itself about its urban condition, debating with itself about the nature of the religious service and the relationship of God to the people in the congregation. And how can we depict this as accurately as possible, understanding that it may not be so singular? It may be more complicated than that. And it's explaining that kind of complexity. And it's an attitude about life and the world and religion, and it's being embodied in the building. And then we also looked toward the end at another set of issues that is often described in architecture, which is technique or technology. So we can see the huge transition from a technology in the Renaissance, in the case of San Andrea in Mantua by Alberti, where it's all about stone. How does stone work? What is the technology of stone? How do you make a wall? How do you make an opening? How does gravity move through that? And the architecture is explaining that technology. And then in the early 20th century, when we begin to get steel and glass and new construction technologies, and people can look around and see airplanes, freaking things lighter than air, and they're freaking flying. You know, and why are we building buildings out of heavy, solid, stupid stone? Why shouldn't we be making it out of something that is the technology of our day, which is light and delicate and open? And so you get, the Schroeder House by Rietveld that's discussing the technology of that period about a completely different kind of material and life with technology that's very, very different than that old stone, heavy, massive stuff that came before. And then we're going to see the extreme of that in the Centre Pompidou, where this museum is talking to us about, what is a building these days? Well, it's more than just making it stand up. It's heating, it's cooling, it's wiring, it's elevators, escalators, mechanical systems. A building is a freaking machine. That's what it is. It's technology. And so the whole building is this kind of expression of that technology. So I ask you in your Twitter card question to describe to me buildings on the campus. What do they say to you about order or about complexity or about technology? And these were some responses. A number of people and I think this is very accurate, probably 90% of this campus is about order. And it's saying something about education. And it's saying, I mean, would you really want to go to a campus that's totally random? I mean, maybe there is a little bit of something in the educational enterprise that is about order. And definitely this campus has it all over. Here are a few examples. The tower itself and the attachments that form the base express order. The tower forms the very symmetrical appearance, and its base serves a clear purpose in each of the library extensions. It's also the center of the campus, which promotes an even larger order. Absolutely. Someone else says, and there were lots of these on the tower, someone else says the tower displays order. The structure itself is very symmetrical and demands attention. The fact that its clock is its defining feature demonstrates how it keeps order on the campus. Great observations. Then other buildings on the campus that express order. The Home Economics Building, Mary Gearing Hall, its exterior has always drawn my eye due to the unique order. Just from far observation, we can appreciate the symmetry of the courtyard and the unique but simple and admirable shape of the building itself. Someone else says the Texas Memorial Museum expresses order. The way it does so is through its symmetry and its solid geometric shapes. Also, it is made of heavy materials with a color palette that speaks of simplicity, order, and strength. Then there were people who found buildings on the campus that expressed complexity. Some really good observations here. Someone says, a building on the UT campus that expresses complexity is the McComb School of Business. The building looks as though two different structures were joined to form one very unique structure. While one side looks modern and has lots of fenestration, the other side is brick and more traditional. The interior of the building is also complex. I know that because I constantly have to refer to a map inside when I'm trying to find my class. Someone else says, I think Gregory Gym expresses complexity in its very being. You have the original gym made of brick, and then as the school grew and needed to accommodate more students, they added the big glass building on the side. Two levels of walkway connect the old and the new to make it seemingly related. In both of those cases, we see a complexity that comes over time. You know, that in one era, some things are important and they're being expressed in the building, and in another era, it's changed and something else is important. But we see the two in some ways demonstrating that change over time and creating a kind of complexity there. Really great observations. Someone else says the student union exhibits complexity. While there are regular modern study areas and restaurants, there are also grandiose and detailed areas for a banquet hall or for a presidential library. These two levels unite to form a complex of student life. Again, that's a really interesting observation because that building has, my God, there's freaking everything in there. There's a movie theater, there's a bowling alley, there's restaurants, there's grand ballrooms, there are meeting rooms. The complexity of that program almost dictates the complexity of that building, which is very different maybe from the more singular program of a building that's just all classrooms or a building that's just all research labs. So that complexity is palpable in the form of the building. A couple of people observed the issue of technique demonstrated in buildings on the campus. Someone says, Bill Gates' computer science building expresses technology. It's a very orderly looking building, but has huge glass windows and layers of platforms. It expresses newness and a place of learning and a technological world that is moving fast. Someone else says, I think that the SAC conveys technique. Most of the buildings on campus use old technology like brick and stone. But the SAC uses lighter, more modern materials like steel and glass. Very good application of those ideas to buildings you can see around on the campus. So today, we're exploring this notion of form in yet another way. And we're going to be looking at architecture maybe in a slightly different way than we're accustomed to thinking of it. This is actually the, I have this huge dictionary that sits on my desk. I inherited it, and it's just a crazy, big, stupid paper dictionary. But it's the Webster's Unabridged Encyclopedic Dictionary. It's just got everything in it. And so in its definition of architecture, the first couple of definitions are ones we're familiar with. It's like architecture is like buildings, okay? But down about the sixth definition of maybe 12 definitions there, about the sixth one says that architecture is the underlying structure of anything. Architecture is the underlying structure of anything. Now, what it means by that is the way we use the term architecture to, like, if we say the architecture of this political campaign, or the architecture of this novel, or the architecture of this software. And we use that term all the time. In fact, probably it's used more now than ever before. And what we're really talking about is the underlying structure of that novel, or the underlying structure of that political campaign, or the underlying structure of that software. So when we're talking about the architecture of a novel, we're talking about its most basic organizational structural devices that give it its character. When we're talking about the architecture of a software program, we're looking at that sort of outline of how the code is going to work. That's the architecture of that software. Now, why the hell would we use the word architecture to describe these things that have nothing to do with buildings? Why is that term, architecture, used to describe the underlying structure of something? And there's a really good explanation for that. Because in the field of architecture, there is this fundamental characteristic of architecture that it has this underlying structure. You can't really make or think about a sophisticated piece of architecture without thinking about or creating this underlying structure. And it's so fundamental to the field, it's so fundamental to the making of architecture or the understanding of architecture, that that term architecture begins to be applied to anything that has an underlying structure, because underlying structure is so fundamental to architecture. So we, in understanding the form of a building, we have to understand how it has this underlying structure, how the underlying structure of a building affects its form. Now, maybe let me explain a little better what I mean by underlying structure. So when I was in architecture school, I also took a degree in business at the Sloan School at MIT. And so the Sloan School was a very, at the time, kind of revolutionary business school. It was very different from the traditional business school. And they actually had cross-registration with Harvard. So you could take classes at Harvard Business School, and you could take classes at the Sloan School. And they were diametrically opposed philosophies of how you do business. So it was really interesting. And I took two classes down at Harvard Business School, but most of my classes were at Sloan. And there was a very explicit differentiation between the way they looked at how you make business decisions. So at Harvard Business School, they used what was called the case study method. And that meant that you, in your classes, you were constantly looking at these case studies. You would read these case studies, and man, it was just excruciating. You have, you know, one every class period almost. So you'd read this whole case study, and then you'd come to class, and they would like grill you about this case study. Well, what were the constants? What were the variables? What was going on in this situation? Who did what? How did they manage that? What decisions did they make? Were they right decisions? Were they the wrong decisions? And what you were trying to do was educate your intuition so that you as a business person could then, when you faced a business problem, you would have in your background of your mind, you'd have all these possibilities, all of these analogies, all of these instances that you could intuitively rely on, and you would make good decisions because you'd learned about from case studies what good decisions look like. And that was a kind of educating your intuition to make ad hoc decisions. And they thought that was the way you train people to make good business decisions. Down at MIT, they had a really different attitude about this, and it was shaped significantly by a guy named Jay Forster, who had been there in the sort of founding days of the Sloan School of Business. And he was a early computer geek guy, and he wrote a bunch of books. One most famous book he wrote was called Industrial Dynamics. He wrote one called Urban Dynamics. But what he said was that business is a dynamic system. There is an underlying structure to business. And when you make a business decision, you need to understand the underlying structure that's at work, and then you can make a good decision. But these are very complex underlying structures. And each business instance has its own underlying structure, and you have to understand that in order to make a good decision. So I can remember in one of the classes I took from one of his acolytes, we were looking at a dairy farm and trying to decide how do you make decisions about making your herd bigger, making your herd smaller, your profitability. And there's all kinds of variables about, how much land you own and how much grass it can grow and what the weather forecast is. And then there's things about the price of cows and the price of milk and the price of labor. And there's, so you make these elaborate equations that recreate the underlying structure of this dynamic system of how a dairy farm works and how you make profit. And so our project that semester was making all these equations and then writing this computer program that would analyze, should we buy more stock? Should we sell more stock? What happens if the price of milk goes here? What happens if it goes there? What happens if the price of cows go up or go down? What happens if the weather changes? So you understand this dynamic system, and then you plug your variables in, and you get answers that are sometimes quite counterintuitive. So in the one instance, we have ad hoc decision making based on intuition and experience. On the other hand, we have systematic decision making based on understanding the underlying structure of this dynamic system that is in operation. Now, as a student in that situation, looking at these two ways of thinking, the systematic way of thinking was absolutely second nature, because that's what my architectural education had said, that's how you make decisions. You're always looking for the underlying structure of anything. And you're looking to find that system around which then you can make other design decisions. And this is built into architectural education for centuries, actually. Probably the most famous architecture school that ever existed is a place called the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. It's still in existence. But in the 19th century, early 20th century, for 60 or 70 years, this was the top school of architecture in the world, hands down. No debate. It was the most amazing school of architecture, and it spawned all the best architects in the world. And they had a very structured way of teaching. And that way of teaching emphasized getting this conceptual or underlying structure approach to building built into the design process. So the way it worked was like this. At the beginning of the term, I might give you, let's say I gave you a problem to design a major urban library. And so you would have like a week or maybe 10 days. And you would do what was called a charrette. And in that week or 10 days, you would find out everything you could about that building, about its program, how many people, how many books, how many checkouts, how many reading room spaces, you would find out everything you could about the climate and the solar orientation and the site and the economics. And you found out everything you could in this week or 10 days. In the charrette, you would madly rush around getting all this information, and then you would try to find a concept, what they called an équisse in French, which essentially means scheme, a scheme for this project. And what you would be looking for is an underlying structure around which you would make all the other decisions. It's not a solution to the problem, but it's a kind of outline or an underlying structure of how to approach this problem. And after that week or 10 days was up and the charrette was ended, everybody would have to hand in these drawings that would show your concept for the semester. And it was make or break, because for the rest of the semester, you would be tied to that concept. You would have to elaborate on that concept. So everything was about getting your scheme, your concept, your keys, or your partie exactly right. And they called it a charrette because there was a little cart, and charrette is the word for cart in French, and they would take a little cart around in the studio at the end of that week or 10 days, and everybody would have to put their drawings in the cart, and that was the deadline, and that was the killer big decision moment. Did you get your concept right? If you didn't, you're screwed for the rest of the semester. If you did, you've got the potential for designing a really good building. This is the essential component of discovering the underlying structure of anything in a design problem. So how do you do that? What does that look like? Well, for one thing, it requires the research and the understanding of the whole problem. And then this is not an arbitrary thing, an arbitrary concept. And unfortunately, these days in architecture, sometimes people think that passes for a decent concept, but it should not be arbitrary. It needs to be very much tailored to that situation. And you're seeking something that is responsive to the program, the function, the climate, the site, the economics. It's supposed to be responsive to all those things, this very particular kind of concept that addresses that problem. But then it is essential in then giving form to the problem. It gives you that general approach to form. And that's why we're talking about it here. It is so important in creating the form of a building. Okay, so that's what we're talking about today, is how do you get that system, that underlying structure, and what is its impact on creating the form of a building or even of a city. So we're going to start at the scale of a city, and we're going to start here in Austin. And some of you may know, I said it when we did our campus tour, that Austin was actually founded in 1839 as the capital of Texas. And they'd had the Revolutionary War against the Mexicans in 1836. For a while, they'd had the capital in Washington on Brazos. Then Sam Houston got to be the president. And these two entrepreneurs down in a little town called Harrisburg on the coast said, "Look, Sam, if you'll move the capital to our little burg here and therefore give us a lot of economic vitality, we'll rename our little town Houston." And so he said, "Dude, I'm in." So they moved the capital down to Harrisburg, renamed it Houston, and for a few years while Sam Houston was the president, that was working fine. Then after he stopped being president, they said, "That was bullshit." You know what? Pure vanity, just pure political vanity. So we're not having a capital in Houston anymore. And they said, "Let's find a new site for the capital and let's make it sensible this time. Number one, it needs to be in the center of the state, not way off on the edge like Houston was." And that was particularly important because this big geographical area still was not secure completely. The Mexicans still wanted to gain some property by making raids from the south, and the Indians still wanted to protect their turf by making raids from the west. So if your capital was way, way over on the east, you didn't have an outpost that could effectively claim this big geographical area you were calling Texas. So they wanted to move it out to the west so that you could protect to the south to Mexico, you could protect to the west from the Indians. So they sent a little expedition troop up the Colorado River, which was in this right geographical area, to select a site for this new city. And they selected the site of, it was near a little town called Waterloo, not exactly the same location, but what is now Austin. And they did that for significantly geographical reasons. Let me just read you a little bit from the report. The little troop came back to the powers that be, President Mirabeau B. Lamar, and said, here's the site, and this is why we chose it. And in that report, they said, "The imagination of even the romantic will not be disappointed on viewing the valley of the Colorado and the fertile and gracefully undulating woodlands and luxuriant prairies at a distance from it. The most skeptical will not doubt its healthiness, and the citizen's bosom must swell with honest pride when standing on the portico of the capital of his country and looking abroad upon a region worthy only of being the home of the brave and the free." So they had, from the very beginning, imagined this geographical connection of this city to the land, this land that they thought was incredibly beautiful. And as I mentioned when we toured around the campus, but I didn't have the graphics to show you, and now I can show you, what they saw from the Colorado River, which was right here, or the Colorado River right here as they came up it, they saw this low rise of ground up to a hill that was right in the center there. There was a bluff on one side to the west and a bluff on the other side to the east. At the base of each bluff, there was a creek, what now is Waller Creek, that runs down here, and what now is Shoal Creek that runs down here. And sort of symmetrically there was the two bluffs, the two creeks, the slow rise, and this hill right in the middle. And they imagined the Capitol building would sit on the hill, and just as that quotation said, would then, you could sit on the portico of the Capitol building and look down this valley and see the Colorado River and the hills beyond, and that was the ensemble of experience that seemed just right to them for a capital of the home of the brave and the free. So that was the geographical area. Now, along comes a guy named Edwin Waller, and he is asked to design the city, to begin to lay out what is the form of this city going to be. Now, at the time, there would have been a very logical way to organize a city, and that was on a grid. And the grid went back to the Greeks. The Greeks used grids to organize their cities as early as 400 BC, long, long, long time ago. So the grid was pretty common. Thomas Jefferson, when we did the Louisiana Purchase, and the United States was about to inhabit this large region of the midsection of the continent, he superimposed a mile-by-mile grid over all of that area, and they surveyed it and laid out this grid. And then within that mile-by-mile grid, then they would make subgrids and subgrids and subgrids all the way down to blocks of towns and cities. And from Thomas Jefferson's point of view, that was very democratic. It was very non-hierarchical. It was very American. So the grid came from Greece, which was a democracy. And then it got transferred to America, which adopted it very much as a non-hierarchical, egalitarian, American kind of expression. And then all over Texas in the 19th century, there had already been little towns established on a grid. Again, this kind of American democratic notion. And probably there's some of you who lived in those towns. So these days you see lots and lots of small towns in Texas like, Gonzales, Waxahachie, Madisonville, Goliad. I mean, they're just all over. And they have usually a grid of streets and squares. And then in the center is a county courthouse. That's in the middle square. Around it are the commercial buildings, and then beyond that are the residential buildings. So how many of you are from a town that's sort of like that? Okay, so we don't get many people from rural Texas. What's your town? What?
Gonzales.
Gonzales is actually a really fantastic one because it has kind of multiple squares in the downtown area. It's a great one. But anyway, that was the normal way you would do it. So Edwin Waller would have known this. But now, it's not good enough to take an arbitrary plan like that. So you could have taken one of those plans that maybe were done on a flat site in a generic place, like maybe Waxahachie, which had no particular geographical features, and you could just lay it out there and make the center and the courthouse and the square around it and all that. But Edwin Waller was saying, no, I want an appropriate underlying structure. So I need to find the right acquis or scheme or concept that fits this geographical situation. So he lays out a grid that is 14 blocks by 14 blocks. At the hill, there is a special green space where the Capitol building is to sit. And then on that axis, there is Congress Avenue that goes down to the Colorado River right there. So he's acknowledged the hill, the symmetry of the hill, the connection between the hill and the river, and that begins to be the spine for his concept. And then he identifies four squares, that one, and that one, that are open parks, and they still are, Brush Square and Republic Square and these open parks that would be a part of the city. And then he takes that grid out to the bluff on this side, basically over to West Avenue, just on the other side of Shoal Creek. And then he takes it over to the bluff on this side, which is he calls East Avenue, and that's just on the other side of Waller Creek. So he uses the geography and the hill and the bluffs and the creeks and all of this to warp that grid notion to make a particular grid for Austin. And then he names the streets Congress Avenue down the center, East Avenue on the east side, West Avenue on the west side, and then all the other north-south streets are named for the rivers of Texas. And if you know your geography of rivers in Texas from east to west, they move in that order from east to west. So the easternmost street is Sabine, which is the easternmost river, which is the border with Louisiana. And then it just goes geographically, the rivers of Texas, all the way to the Rio Grande, which is the westernmost river, which is basically, you know, the border with Mexico and New Mexico. So he names all of that for the streets of Texas, and it's again tied to the geography. Then he named the east-west streets. The first one down here was Water Street. I told you on the tour that the one at the perpendicular axis of the Capitol building was College Avenue, and it went out in that direction up to the old college campus on that side of the city. And then the other east-west streets were named for the trees of Texas, so like Live Oak and Mesquite and Peach and Bodark and Elm and all of those tree names. So again, geographical names. Later, those were changed to numbered streets, but originally they were named for the trees. So he has made this underlying structure for the city. And at first, it just is on paper like that. But it gives this framework around which to make decisions about the city. And that framework, to this day, has had a very profound effect on the form of Austin. Most of you probably, if you came from another city and you came here, it made it easier for you to negotiate the city. If somebody told you, you know, I want to meet you on the corner of 6th and Congress Avenue, that was never a problem. I can understand 6 blocks up from the river, and I can understand Congress Avenue as that central spine of the whole thing. If you even knew your rivers of Texas, which probably nobody does much anymore, if they said, I'll meet you on Lavaca, you'd know exactly where that sat in relation to Guadalupe or San Antonio or other rivers and streets in Texas or in Austin. So this structure was there from the very beginning. And then the city began to grow into that structure. But it was the underlying structure that gave that form to the city. It told people where to do what. It was the basis for subsequent design decisions. So for example, originally, and this is a map that was drawn in, or a little drawing, that was done in the 1850s, and by then they had built the old Capitol building on that hill. See a little hill there and the space around it, and they built the Capitol building there. That's the governor's mansion, which is still there. This is now 11th Street right there. It's called Mesquite Street. But that building's still there. That's there. All the streets are still there. And that was the old Capitol building. Again, it was addressing Congress Avenue as it went down to the river in that direction. Now, that building was a little crappy thing, and it wasn't nearly the scale that was appropriate to hold its own in this big geography. And so, thankfully, in the 1880s, it burned to the ground, or someone torched it, I don't know. But anyway, it disappeared. And in the 1880s, they built that badass big stone Capitol building that was big enough to hold the top of the hill and to make that connection down to the river. And but where that Capitol building is, what that Capitol building is like, what way it faces, you know, the general form of the Capitol building was dictated by this underlying structure of the city. And then obviously on that street that would have connected the Capitol building to the river, then you began to get the more commercial buildings of the city. And you can see these three or four or five-story buildings cropping up in the 1850s. Away from that, it's just little houses, farmland, orchards, gardens, cow pasture. Away in either direction, it's almost nothing. But originally, you see exactly the underlying structure told you where to put the commercial buildings. And it told you what the future of the city would be there. So that was being followed carefully. This is a similar kind of axonometric drawing that was done in the 1880s. Here again, we see there's Congress Avenue going up like that. The sort of larger buildings on Congress Avenue there, they're culminating in the Capitol building. Now we've got that badass big Capitol building up there on the square facing down to Congress Avenue. At this point, that's Old Main, the old university building that was built in the 1880s up on the next hill up there. But again, these decisions about where to put commercial buildings, where to put the university, where they were implied in the original plan. And then down toward the river, the land was lower. It was flood prone down there. So that's where they put the railroad. There's much less development down there. You can see it's kind of cow pasture a little bit. But the grid is still organizing the plots of land there and holding a space for later. Now all that's high-rise condo buildings. But it gave a kind of placeholder of form that at the beginning was cow pasture, later turned into smaller commercial buildings, maybe warehouses that serve the railroads. And then later today, because you have beautiful views and because they dammed the river and so there's no longer it's no longer flood prone. Now it's a beautiful lake and it's got hike and bike trails, and now there are big high-rise condo buildings along it. So that underlying structure allowed all those things to change. This is not working, yeah, for some reason. Is it back again? Okay, so, you know, all these decisions about the
exactly what James Oglethorpe was trying to do. So how did he incorporate those social attitudes into an underlying form that would then shape the city of Savannah? So he started out with this notion of a ward. And a ward was a little community. It had a little park or a square in the center of it. It had a place for the more public buildings, and then it had a place for the more private residences. But every little piece of the city would have a ward. So if you were a new citizen here, you would live in a ward, and there might be like 500 people who lived in your ward. And then there'd be another ward next to it, there was another 500 people. But there'd always be this unit, this small sense of community. So originally there were four wards, each with a park in the center. One, two, three, four wards. And then a few years later, they added two more. They had six wards, and then eight wards, and the city grew, but always in the module of these smaller communities. So, like I said, there's a park in the center. There's a place here where there might be churches or schools or things like that. And then there were the residential areas that would be in these blocks over here. And as those things would add together, each of those little wards like that around its park would have that strong sense of community. And they would all be able to have their own little local shopping and their own local church or community center or something that would keep them tight as a social unit. And then as it added together, there would be places where you could move through the city on your carriage pretty directly, but there also then would be these pedestrian ways that would always be interrupted by the parks. So there would be, you can move through the city in this very gentle, sweet, socially oriented way along that park area. So the underlying structure of the city was built around this notion of an immediate community and then adding those communities together, but still keeping the intimacy of this 400 or 500 person unit. And this is the way it developed, the beautiful park in the foreground. These are two churches that are on one of those parks. So that, again, these healthy cultural institutions are very prominent on the social space. You spill out of the church, the kids go play in the park. You hang out, you get to know your neighbors better. Maybe you come for a picnic. At lunch in the park, you see the people coming out of the church. Everybody interacts with each other. There's a good social environment that makes people want to be responsible and not debtors and not slackers and not irresponsible. So it was meant to engender a social atmosphere. And then in other parts, there would just be these very kind of modest row houses. And then occasionally, as somebody got a little money, some of those sort of institutional spots began to be people's houses that were leaders in business or leaders in the community and so on. So it developed as a very healthy social environment. But again, the underlying structure had everything to do with its eventual form. Now, we can understand that that happens at the scale of a city. Let's imagine how does that happen at the scale of a building. So again, we're using the grid as an underlying structure, as a device. So in a way, the grid is an underlying structure. Like if you were writing a piece of music and you said, okay, I'm going to do it in 4-4 time, or I'm going to do it in 2-4 time. Or if you're writing a piece of music, you might say, I'm going to use a sonata form. Or if you're writing a piece of music, you might say, I'm going to use a rap format. And obviously, these underlying structures would create completely different kinds of music. So the grid, as a kind of generic thing, is saying, okay, that's the general format I'm using. The particular concept of that grid, as we saw in those two instances of Austin and Savannah, make it more appropriate to a specific instance. So the same thing happens with a grid in the case of a building. In this case, we're looking at the Central Beheer offices in Apeldoorn, Holland. It's about maybe 70 miles east of Amsterdam, a modest-sized town. This is the biggest employer in town. They're coming in, they're building this large, they're an insurance company, and people are actuaries mostly in this building. So they're building this big corporate insurance complex. And it employs about 1,000 people, so it's pretty good size.
So they're again breaking it down into smaller units. And in this case, they want, you know, if there are 1,000 people that work for the company, they want some smaller unit of people that will kind of work together and will have some sense of intimacy within that larger organization. So there's the collection of all of these pods. And all of these pods are then located in a grid like we're seeing here. And it actually interfaces with the rest of the city in that in this direction is like the main train station. And in this direction is the main parking area. In this direction is a major like downtown retail connection. And in this area is a major residential area. So there's a desire line to go between those various things. And at the intersection of those two axes is this little square right here where you see the diagonals are. And that's where the major circulation, vertical circulation, there are escalators. That's where all the cafes are. And this is really, because it's for 1,000 employees, they need a place for people to have their lunch. So instead of having a cafeteria, they have a series of cafes. They have to have meeting rooms, and those are all located around that same kind of central square at the intersection of those two axes. And then around that is this grid with all these pods. And what it is a pod and an interstitial space and another pod and an interstitial space and a pod, so that in both directions, you get this interstitial space that goes between these solid pods of the building. And each pod would be some kind of working unit. And sometimes they might want more privacy, so they might have glass block that encloses their pod. Sometimes they might want more openness, so it might be just completely open like that. Here, and sometimes they might have glass, clear glass in there. Sometimes they might have just mini blinds. There's all kinds of levels of connection or disconnection, and those can change over time so that depending on what department moves in there, they can alter their space. Also, individuals that move in here have the ability to personalize it. There is this very strong order and structure that goes through the whole building, but people can personalize it however they want, bring in their plants or bring in their photos of their kids or whatever they want. And that can then make more specific and individual spaces within this larger complex. And then, as I said, at the intersection of these things, then you get this kind of town square where the escalators are that move up and down, and they have little cafe spaces for people to have their lunch. Your family could come for lunch. Your friends from town could come for lunch. It's completely open to anybody who wants to dine there. Also, their meeting rooms are in that general area, so the conferencing spaces are there. And you see other people from the company, maybe not in your department, but you see them at lunch or you see them in these conferencing areas. So it gives a little more social atmosphere to the whole building. But that underlying structure of the grid is never absent anywhere you go. It is actually determining the structural system of the building, these great cross-shaped piers that hold up the building. It is also organizing the mechanical systems in the building that run in these interstitial spaces. So just as in Austin, in the streets, all the sewer and water and electric and telephone and all of that runs in the streets and serves the blocks. So in this case, all the mechanical systems run in the interstitial spaces and then serve all the pods that are on either side. There you can see that from above. And again, those interstitial spaces have these skylights so that it lets lots of natural light in the center of the building as well. And over time, this actually has changed significantly, just as over time, the city of Austin changed. What was a cow pasture became high-rise condos. In this one, maybe one department becomes another apartment, or the density gets a little higher of workers here or less high, depending on the demand. But that underlying structure stays there, the sort of conceptual basis of the whole building, and really is what is giving it form. Okay, so the grid is one kind of underlying structure. And there are many, many potential underlying structures. So for instance, maybe some of you grew up in a house that was a T shape. And maybe one wing of the house, one piece of that T, was a living room, dining room, kitchen. And maybe the other wing of the house or piece of that T was all the bedrooms. That would be the underlying structure of your house is public spaces in one piece of the T, private spaces in other piece of the T. Maybe some of you grew up in a house that was U-shaped, or maybe there was living room, dining room, kitchen in the middle, and then a wing over here for the master bedroom, and a wing over here for the kids' bedrooms. Now, that's a very different underlying structure than the T. And the T puts all the bedrooms together, you, mom, dad, everybody, they're on your back all the time. The U allows the kids to have their own wing, the parents to have their own wing, and that underlying structure is a very different social structure for your family. It gives you, as a 13, 14, 15-year-old, more independence, more ability to feel a little disconnected from the controlling eye of your parents. And it's a different underlying structure to your house. And then that begins to give form to the rest of your house. So just as the grid is an underlying structure, that T or that U might be an underlying structure. Here's another underlying structure. This is one that Le Corbusier, we looked at his chapel at Ronchamp earlier. You're reading Experiencing Architecture. Rasmussen loves Le Corbusier's ass. I mean, it's just constantly lots and lots of examples in here. Our Le Corbusier, the Unité d'Habitation, the Villa Savoie, meaning he has Ronchamp in there. Guy loves his ass. So you should get to know this name, Le Corbusier, fairly well. But what I'm talking about here is Le Corbusier, this very famous 20th century architect, Swiss, practiced in Paris most of his life. In the 1930s, he gets interested in this underlying structure. And he's not designing a particular building. He's just exploring this underlying structure of what were at the time called Catalan vaults. So this was a system where in the southern part of Spain, sort of southeastern part of Spain in Catalan, they would have all these places where they stored wine. It was big wine country. And what they do is they build into the hill these caves, caves. And they were built with these masonry vaults so that you saw the sort of brick vault on the top. And there were long, thin tubes of space. And that was just the right dimension for having racks of wine on one side and racks of wine on the other side. And they went into the hillside so it would stay cool and an even temperature all year round. And so Le Corbusier visited these caves, these vaults in Catalan, and he said, I love these sort of repetitive vaults. So he's thinking, is there an application for that underlying structure, these tubes of space? So he's just, at this point in this drawing, he's just exploring it. He's thinking, well, maybe they could be like townhouses, and each vault would be a townhouse. And you know, maybe people have their living room, dining room, kitchen at one end, their bedrooms at the other end, and you know, it would be under these vaults. He's imagining that. Then he does this whole village where everything's made out of these vaults. So it's actually a farming village, so it has a silo here. And the silo is like a vertical version of the vaults, and you'd sort of tip the silo over on the side. And it becomes, you know, in this case, kind of industrial buildings where there are trucks that can back into these long, thin spaces. So it's an appropriate shape for that truck loading function. He imagines maybe a tall building with tall vaults like that. He imagines maybe instead of having solid walls on the side, which those caves had, where they had masonry and then masonry walls, he thought, well, maybe you could put rows of columns there. So these are just columns supporting those vaults. But you know what he's doing? He's just freaking playing around. He's just playing around. He's imagining this underlying structure. What could you do with it? What are the possibilities? And he didn't build, in the 1930s when he's doing this, he did not build a single building that had anything like this. He's just exploring an underlying structure. And then in the 1950s, he got a commission to do a house in India. And this house, he thinks, aha, this is a place where that underlying structure makes sense. So this is a house for a very large extended family, the Sarabhai family. So this is like, Mama Sotheby, big, fat, extremely wealthy woman who has like a bunch of sons. All of the sons then have their wives and their kids, and there's this big extended family that's living in the Villa Sotheby. And it is in this very interesting neighborhood in Ahmedabad in India, where they have, it's way more than a gated community. It is an area that is secure and protected where rich people live. There's a huge income divide between rich and poor in Ahmedabad, and so that you don't have the poor people stealing from the rich people, they have this whole district of town that has extremely high security, their own private security. It has a wall built around it, and you can't even get in there unless you have permission from one of the families. So this isn't just in the middle of the city, it's completely secure. And so within that, you don't really have to worry about having a lock on your door or having a door at all, because it's completely secure within this compound. So, all right, I'm building this house for an extended family, very wealthy, in this place where I don't have to worry about security at all. The entire precinct is this beautiful forest. Oh my God, gorgeous landscape. It's a hot climate. This is all really shady and nice breezes that go through. So I want to make this house so that it interlocks with the landscape as much as possible. I don't have to worry about it being secure, even having doors, windows. It's not air conditioned, so that it's just relying on the natural breezes to cool it. So he's thinking now this is an appropriate place for this underlying structure of these tubes of space and these vaults. So he makes these long, thin spaces. Sometimes they have walls, like we saw in the caves. And sometimes they have columns, like we saw him experimenting with. But there's always a line of structure that goes here. And then there's always a vault, 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 all the way through it. And sometimes it might make a perfectly good carport like that. The dimension and all works like that. Sometimes it might be just a big open porch so you could interact with the landscape there. Sometimes it might be a little unit for her single son that still didn't have a family. And it would be a bedroom area and a living room area and a kitchen and a study and a place for a guest and a bathroom. Just a little apartment that takes up two of those little vaults. But then as the family grew, he might get married, he might have some kids, then they could spread out to that porch and there would be a place to expand his little apartment over here. And this is where the big Mama Sotheby lives, and those are much more spacious area for her bedroom or for the big living room, dining room, kitchen where you have big family gatherings. So it's this very flexible underlying structure that can grow and change over time, and that also can accommodate all these different functions of this extended family. And this is what it looks like inside. It's got the vaults, and sometimes they're walls like this, and sometimes they're just columns, and the spaces all kind of interlock with each other. There's always that connection to the landscape. Those tubes of space are taking your eye out to the garden. Everywhere you feel like you're in the garden. You're in this shady, cool, cave-like space with the breezes going through and connecting you to the garden. The underlying structure came from the site, the social attitude, those real parameters of the problem, but then at a certain point it takes on its own life and it begins to create these intimate rooms made from these vaults up above. And the house becomes this series of vault, 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 all the way through it. And sometimes that vault space might be a study, and sometimes it might be part of the living room, and sometimes it might be a part of a bedroom. And the amount of connection or disconnection could even change over time as they put additional partitions in the form of the house. But that is, again, using the underlying structure of these tubes of space to create now a house that has... You can't understand its form without understanding its concept, its keys, its underlying structure. So, years later, Liu Kahn, in 1972, designs the Kimball Art Museum in Fort Worth. And again, no time in his entire career has he used this particular underlying structure. But for this building in Fort Worth, he thinks, ah, this just exactly fits what I need done here, and I will use this underlying structure. So how many of you have been to the Kimmel Museum? It's good. That's a reasonable number. The rest of you are just dumbass idiots. This is probably the best piece of architecture in the state of Texas. This one is the sine qua non. This one is an amazing, amazing piece of architecture. So get your ass up to Fort Worth and see the Kimball Museum, because I can't describe it. My description will be completely inadequate. It's way, way, way better when you're there. So it obviously is these tubes of space or vaults. In this case, there's a vault and an interstitial space and a vault and an interstitial space. It actually is made up of a structural system that is four columns that then support this long vault, which in some ways is more like a big bent beam that spans between those. So structurally, it makes really great sense. The depth of the vault makes a really good beam shape, and it sits on these four corners. And that kind of makes the porch on the front of the Kimball Museum, and you can see it really clearly, how the vault sits on the column, and then there's an interstitial space, another vault. So it explains to you right at the beginning of the building, at the porch, what the underlying structure is. And then it's made up of 18 of these vaults that go like that through the building. And there's a little indentation for a courtyard at the entry here. And then there are these tiny little courtyards that are carved out sometimes, just sort of hollowed out of the vault. And sometimes the light comes in these little seams between the vaults like that, and you get just this little glow of light. And then otherwise, you get these long, thin tubes of space. On one side, it's one story high, and then as the land falls off, on the other side, it's two stories high. So it actually merges into the ground in a very good way. They were trying to protect the view from the Amon Carter Museum up the hill, and so it was important on this side that it stay low, but then as it goes down the hill, it gets taller, as you can see right there. And there's that porch with that. Okay, here's what the system is. I'm telling you, this is one unit, that's another unit. There are 18 of those, and that system is what makes up the building. Now, this system is so appropriately chosen. So he's thinking, I've got a structural system I've got to do. So this is actually providing the structural system, these columns, and then this huge bent beam that crosses across them. And the vault is a good structural shape, so that's all. It does a good job of structure. It also is a way of creating in a museum that has to be flexible, but at the same time you want a kind of intimacy and not just big generic gym-like spaces. So that vault creates a little more intimacy in individual areas. And the collection the Kimball Museum had is not gargantuan big paintings or tiny little paintings. It's paintings that are about this size, and they need a scale that is a kind of room-like scale. And in fact, the director of this museum had been at the Phillips Collection, a really good museum before, which was in an old kind of palatial house. And he said, I want the intimacy of that kind of palatial house, but at the same time, I want the flexibility that I can move in a changing exhibition. So he gives, the vault gives that intimacy, and yet the openness and the lack of columns and all of that and walls gives you the flexibility there. Another really important aspect of the vault is the fact that it has all the mechanical systems in the interstitial space. So all of the ductwork, all the wiring, all the what little plumbing there is, it's all in that interstitial space. So the vault can be exposed all the way up to the ceiling and not have to have a drop ceiling for all that technology that has to go through it. So that organizes where the mechanical systems are. And then in the top of the vault itself, he makes a skylight that goes all the way across there. He brings in that really intense Texas sun through the skylight. He makes this stainless steel perforated metal baffle that then reflects the light back up to the shiny underside of the concrete vault, and in a way makes a light fixture of that vault. The light comes in, bounces up, that glowing light then gives natural illumination to the galleries below. So you don't get the very deleterious UV rays that would destroy the paintings. Now it's bounced around and it's soft. You don't get the terrible heat gain of the summer Texas sun, but you do get this soft natural light, the natural light that lets you see the colors in the paintings much better than artificial light. And then there are little bitty perforations in that that gets just the smallest amount of direct sunlight down into the room. So the vault is the structural system. The vault and the interstitial spaces are giving your mechanical spaces. The vault is the light fixture for the building, basically giving the daylighting system. And the vault is given this intimacy of a room-like space within a very flexible plan of the building. And then occasionally you need a little supplemental light or relief, so you get a little courtyard carved out with a little fountain in it, and that gives another kind of experience at a few places within that system. And then there are oddball uses like the auditorium. Most of the building is galleries, but part of it is an auditorium, which takes one vault and one interstitial space to make that auditorium. In one of the vaults, there's a kind of attic up here, and there's a little intimate study library, and it's tucked under the vault. So there's a way to use that system, you know, to warp itself somewhat for these more particular functions like an auditorium or a smaller library. The result of that is this really strong form, this amazing character of a building inside and outside that is so much informed by its underlying structure. And the underlying structure is really what's making the Kimball Museum so powerful, so dynamic, and yet at the same time, it's making the mechanical systems work, it's making the electrical systems work, it's making the structural system work, it's doing all the functional things that are required for the building as well. So just across the street from the Kimball Museum, that's the Kimball right there, and then across the street they built the Fort Worth Modern Museum in 2002, and this was done by Tadao Ando. There's the Kimball, there's the Modern. Tadao Ando is a huge fan of Liu Kahn, and he took that same concept of the tubes of space, now not vaults, but long linear tubes of space, and those became galleries, as you can see there, and the structural system is based on that long, thin space. The lighting, the natural lighting, comes from that long, thin extrusion of the building. Again, pretty much every characteristic of this building is shaped by that linearity, that long, thin tube of space. So it becomes the, again, underlying structure, organizing device of the building. Okay, now, Twitter card question. This is a tough one. This is, you know, you may just throw up your hands in aggravation here. But I want you to think of a building, any kind of building, your home, your high school, a building here on campus, a dormitory, the apartment building you live in, anywhere you can think of, where you can identify the underlying structure of that building. I want you to think not what does it look like superficially, what is the underlying structure? What are the bones that are shaping that building?